The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I wonder also if, and I don't, some of us, James and we're taking this course Monday nights together on ethnic American churches. And last night, Mr. Hansen took two, but Dr. Imtek Won spoke to us last night on Korean churches. And it was very interesting to me because he was talking about, also talked about the social mobility of the Korean communities. What hit me though, again, as I reflected on last night's lecture, was that by and large, the Korean communities have come to the United States with great wealth. They have not come like the boat people from Cambodia with nothing in there, as desperately poor. They have come with support from their families. They've come with funds so they can move into neighborhoods and they can buy small businesses, and the small businesses become bigger businesses. But what's interesting to me is that as I think about last night and the Korean churches, I find myself thinking there are still a lot of very poor Koreans in the city of Philadelphia. I think Logan area, still the hard working class poor Korean, lower class Korean in terms of social scale. They can't move to North Hills. They can't move to Amber. They can't move to Ardsley. Oh, where is it? Dear, you mentioned it, Jane.
Lansdale.
Oh,
it's mixed up because many of these people live in Lansdale, so people now find now, but there are factories, so we see a lot of factory workers.
That's interesting. In what I struggle with is that. I see the same, often seeing the same patterns in the Korean churches here that I saw in the Korean churches in Korea. And that is that the Korean churches basically are very, a vast bulk of them aim for the middle class and beyond. Whereas there's a great need for planting churches among the poor and the working class, those who don't have the money to have their own business, things like that. I don't know, I'd like to know, for example, how many churches, Korean churches, there would be in Logan area, and how many churches in the Logan area are drawing those kinds of people, or how many churches in Logan area get people from Huntington Valley and other areas who come to the church building. I think that's something that needs to be studied. When I was in Australia, I don't know if I've mentioned this in class, but forgive me if I have. I went to visit Gordon Moyes, who is the director of Wesley Central Mission, big, big church in downtown Sydney. He's an extremely gifted pastor, and he talked to me about, as an illustration, he said that his associate pastor there is Chinese pastor. And he said, I want to know how many unreached Chinese there are in Sydney who are here illegally. So he sent the pastor to visit throughout the city. He sent the pastor to visit Chinese restaurants. And he said, when you go in the back door. And he visited, he found about 2,500 illegal Chinese in Sydney. So they started a worship service for illegal Chinese. And the first Sunday they had 250.
So same kind of situation that you mentioned in Australia.
I wonder if are there Chinese churches in Boston that are trying to reach the illegals?
Yes, that pastor's church, he said he tried to reach that people, but not easy because they are afraid of expulsion.
Yes. Afraid of expulsion.
Yeah. So is there any tab for Chinese? Any tab for Chinese that they have
in the church? Not really. Yes.
No.
I don't exactly know where it's the case anyway. It's outside of Boston, near to the. There's a ship called Constitution, somewhere.
Yes. Now, Old Ironsides. That would probably also be difficult, because if you were illegal Chinese, you probably wouldn't be able to buy a car or things like that. That means that you couldn't get to that church.
The same situation in New York City too. A lot of Chinese are illegally working in the restaurants.
Mike?
Can't you get in trouble with the government for helping us?
Yeah. That's okay. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's.
Yeah, they'll throw you in jail.
I don't know the answer to that one. I would guess it depends on the kind of help you offer. I would think now, for example, in the United States, the government, I think, has opened different kinds of channels where illegals can become legal. And I think that could be a very useful place for deacons to work in the church, to help people like that. But again, I'd say, I guess the church is called to help people whether they're legal or illegal. Our calling is to, and Christ didn't decide whether we were illegal or legal when he went to the cross. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So I think the church had better start modeling the same thing kind of thing. In the United States in the last, 10 years, it's relatively died down now, but there has been many of the churches, a sanctuary movement, particularly for illegals from Central America. I know of 2-3 sanctuary churches in Philadelphia that have housed illegals and have then tried to help them either become a part of American culture legally or just help them move into the society. So there are Christians who differ on just what to do about that. But in any case, it seems to me the church has got an obligation to do whatever they can to ease people's pain and to reach out in compassion to share Christ. And you give cups of cold water to thirsty people. Let me say one more thing before this time ends. And we're just trying to build on this idea of mobility for practical things. Number two, newcomers to the city, because of this idea of mobility, newcomers to the city offer greater potential for fruitful evangelism than those who have resided in the city for some time. Why? Because generally speaking, they tend to be more disoriented. They're not yet settled. They're looking for something, for new roots. They're trying to fit in to something new that is very unfamiliar to them. And I think this is a very powerful example of this is ethnic American churches. Korean churches in the United States are now growing faster than even churches in Korea itself. Why? Is there something magical about that airplane ticket? Buy an airplane ticket, become a Christian? I don't think so. But I think what's happening is that the Korean immigrant arrives in the United States and they need help. How do I shop in a supermarket? I don't understand the language. How do I buy clothes? Where do I go to get help? And often the church is the one place where the Korean culture can be preserved. They can hear people talking to another in Korean, hear preaching in Korean. So the church then becomes the gathering place. The place of stability, the place where the culture is preserved. So some are saying, one doctoral dissertation we have in the library here a few years ago estimated that between 70 to 75% of the Korean population of Southern California are now Christian. And that, if that's true, that's over twice as much as the number in Korea itself. Massive growth. I think it's tied in with the new experience. I suspect that right now in that the Chinese churches in the United States now need desperately to begin a very vigorous program of church planting, because by 1999 the Chinese population in the United States will explode. Then Hong Kong will go into the People's Republic of China, and before that happens, in the next few years, there will be an acceleration of people leaving Hong Kong. Already, there's great growth in Vancouver, British Columbia, San Francisco, California. The churches must get ready for that. Or if they're not ready, what will happen is they will not be able to touch that great harvest. It'll be too late after they come.
I think probably Toronto, city in Canada, will be more. They'll come to Toronto. Yeah, because they are holding British passport. They come to Canada is a Commonwealth country.
That's British. Right.
So it's much easier for them. They can come in and stay for half a year before even just you are applying for visa. So I think a lot they will prepare to go to Canada instead of coming to stay.
I don't know if Lipsing or others have heard this. I read this in Time magazine last week. There have been major changes in the last month or two in the immigration laws of the United States. And the government has said that if you own $1 million and are prepared to invest it in a business in the United States, they will give you a green card. They'll pass all of the rules. So if you have that money and are prepared to invest in a business, they'll admit you. Yeah.
I thought bring in $1 million.
Yeah. Yes. Now, if you are willing to give me $1 million, I will do it for you. This is a real big struggle, I guess. Now, Time magazine when they wrote this up, said this very difficult in an American culture, because our whole concept of immigration for all these hundreds of years has been not to receive the wealthy, but to receive the poor. Give us your poor, your tired, your tempest tossed. You know, that's the great slogan at the bottom of the Statue of Liberty. So the Time magazine article, the headline was, "Give me your tired, your wealthy." but it's changing here.
I see.
And it'd be interesting to see. I think Canada has something similar to that. It'd be interesting to see how that's all going to affect now. And I think the article also said they were having lotteries where they were giving away green cards. Amazing. The potential, if you do it this way, you've got to remember that the potential for church growth among newcomers levels off quickly. It does not take long to adjust to cities. My guess, after reading a few things lately, is that there is a significant drop in receptivity to the gospel after the newcomer has been in the city after about 6 months. It may be even shorter than that. But the sooner the newcomer is reached, the better. Number four. Young people are more open to change than older people. and therefore they should not be neglected in urban evangelism. Young people are quicker to adapt new ideas, new lifestyles. Older people are more set in their ways. I'm getting older. Our daughter is 20 years old. Our youngest daughter is 20 years old. She comes home from college in the summer. She wants to watch MTV day and night. She turns on, she wants to listen to, I think she calls it music. It comes screaming at you out of the radio, and it's boom, boom, bang, bang. And my wife and I are very glad she's going to college many miles away. It was last night, Reverend Lim was so funny. He mentioned that he had two daughters. And he said, I can't understand these daughters at all. Yes.
He has different tribes.
Yes, they're different tribe. The point he made was very interesting, I thought. He said that, he's making the comment that if we're going to reach the second generation of Koreans, he said, we must regard the second generation as a new tribe. We cannot think of them as Koreans. We have to think of them in terms of foreign missions. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in what he said. And it was also interesting because he commented on his hope was to see church models of the future that would be multi-ethnic. And I have not heard many pastors saying that. But it was very interesting.
Yeah.
But he was recognizing how different young people are, I think, in terms of the city. Older people also, I think, often see their roles, their task, as partly the preservation of the family traditions. That means culture, that means also religion. So they're closer to the old way of life than the new one that they perceive in the city. In so-called third world cities, the population size of young people makes this very, very important. In Mexico, for example, in Mexico in 1991, 50% of the population are under the age of 20. That comes from the Latin America Evangelist that was published just this month. 50% under the age of 20. Further, this was Mexico.
Why does that maybe after?
Let me, one more sentence. This was also very interesting in the same issue. 43% of the suicides in 1988, 43%, were committed by people under the age of 20.
Yeah, interesting figure. 50% of the city are young people.
Yes.
Why this this happened?
I think part of it is because there has historically in the past there has been so little good public health. And so the life expectancy in a place like Mexico has been much narrower than here.
Mm.
So you don't live as long, you die more quickly.
Mm.
Also, I think the number of children born in Mexico is much, much larger than some of our countries. But it's very true almost around the world how massive the young people population is. In Manila, I read this also very recently. In Manila, at the present time, somewhere between 50,000 to 75,000 children live on the streets and are homeless.
This kind of phenomena I observe, because I serve in a town called Lada. A lot of Filipinos, refugees coming in. And a lot of children usually gather around
the slum area, especially the slum area in the city. You find a lot of children from 6 to about 12 or 15, that age, right? A lot of these children. And I visited Manila once, also I found a lot of children around the slum area. The slum area is terrible. They've just put all these plywood under the highway, highway. They just try to build simple boxes like that. Under the highway. Mm-hmm. So the area usually find a lot of children running around. They are not going to school. And I just wonder, could it be because of the ignorance of the parents, or because of the young people, or because of the couples? I think there's a social problem and stuff. They are not educated, they don't know how to handle, they just keep on producing children.
I think that's part of it in so many different cultures of the world. In the past, families and children were regarded as great blessings from the spirits and or from God. And so there have been many countries which are very opposed to any kind of birth control or population control because of a cultural background. That has increased numbers of children. Also, I think in some cases it's not due to, why are there so many children? Not due so much to ignorance of the things. It's just the growth of the cities. What are the children doing out on the streets there? Well, because they're pouring in from the rural countryside. And in many cases too, in so many countries, it's not like a place like the United States, where you can send your children to public school and they can get free education all the way to university or college. Mm-hmm. Even Korea, at least when I was there, you had relatively free education, I think, through sixth grade, wasn't it? But then then the costs begin to mount as you go into middle school and high school. And there are many countries in the world which require education only through the sixth grade. So you're going to find all kinds of children on the streets. They have, beyond sixth grade, they have no training. They have no place to go. Dr. Greenway has often mentioned one of his concerns, for example, is in countries you will have large numbers of children who serve as prostitutes, both boys and girls. And this is because this becomes, in some countries of the world, this is a very large industry. The Japanese send tourists throughout Southeast Asia because for sex. It's very painful, but true.
Yeah, I think we are reading a book, The City of God and City of Satan.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. The author mentioned that when he went to visit Calcutta, on a certain street, where a lot of prostitutes. The woman waiting for men, and then the children praying around.
Boy.
Is another factor in the increase of promotion of young people, just the fact that young people are a lot more likely to move from a rural area to the urban area? The older you are, the less likely you are to want to enrich yourself. I'm just thinking, again, in the South African situation, I think that is a factor there. Although there again, of course, the families are large, and I mean that is very much a part of the culture and so on. But I think those figures you quoted, that sounds about, I've heard figures about Soweto, it sounds about the same. It's a massive proportion.
I want to offer another just a PS to this too on young people. I think just the size of the young people's population and
their potential says we must start thinking about churches where young people are involved. I think also here in the United States, when you've got churches where the demographics, where you have churches where most of your members are 60 years of age and more, and then you have a church which suddenly has no young people at all, and you start thinking, what will our church look like in 10 years? Well, in 10 years, your church may be gone, because all of those who are 60 years of age and over will be dead, and you have no young people to grow. So that can be averted if the church decides to focus and make its target group the elderly. Because even though the elderly will die, there'll be more elderly come in since they know that the focus of your church is elderly, also young people. But what I was going to say, adding to this, is that I think there is a danger in all this, that we will concentrate our evangelistic efforts on reaching young people in isolation. There are a number of organizations nowadays that focus on reaching children. Child Evangelism Fellowship, Young Life, all of these different organizations. And I think those are all good, but the danger is trying to reach just the young people. And that's a danger because in patriarchal societies, young people do not count. The important thing are the elderly. So it seems to me a very common mistake then is to move into an area where there are lots of young people, and you start with the young people or the children or even the women, and that is a mistake. Because you've got to, if you are going to do the work, let the young people be the pipeline to the city, to the family, so that you don't aim for the young people in isolation from the family. If you want to get very hard about it, young people don't have money. Parents do. Even though they have a little money, it's still a little. You can't build a church with the money donated by young people.
So what you mean is we must get the whole family involved.
Yeah. Aim for the whole family. Develop evangelistic methods that will not be content with just children, but will seek to reach the families through the children. Also, sometimes in many ministries, young people's evangelism doesn't think seriously about church planting. You go in, you hold meetings for the children, evangelistic meetings. What happens when the meetings are over? Or you conduct Bible classes for the children. What happens when the Bible classes are over? Are the children incorporated into the life of the church? Very often they're not. The follow-up is very, very weak. I was the two issues from now in urban mission will be an issue on youth ministry, on urban ministry to the youth. And one of the most interesting articles is by a brother from Canada, from Toronto, who works with the Yonge Street Mission. And it's down in the heart of Toronto. And it is a ministry to street young people. It's sort of like an old-fashioned rescue mission here in the United States. These are young people who live on the street. But what's fascinating to me, and this is the only place where I've ever heard of this, they don't just sort of minister to the people who come and go. The young people live on the street, but they actually become members of the church. It's not just a rescue mission where you come and go. It is a church, and it is planted among the young people who live on the street. I think that's very, very exciting. It's a whole different way of trying to address the needs of young people, so that you incorporate them into the whole life of the church. You get your elders, the leaders of the church, from some of those young people. They may continue to live on the street, but they'll live Christian lives on the street. The God will bless that ministry. When I was in Australia, we visited several young people's ministry works in Sydney, Australia. And there was one pastor who works in an area called King's Crossing in Sydney. This area is about 2 square blocks and is nothing but bars that are open almost all night. Australia also is now debating whether to legalize brothels, and they have several already brothels that are operating publicly in Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra, the capital. They're operating legally. They're now trying to make prostitution legal throughout the whole country. But here you've got all these problems, and that many of the prostitutes are young women, many of them from Asia, and they're operating in King's Crossing. So one of the pastors is working this area. He has found that it's almost useless to work through the traditional church, because these people will never set foot in a traditional church. So he works at night in the streets. He talks to the young people, works with them, befriends them, shares Christ. Then they have a functioning church on the street. He's not asking them to become middle class, but he is asking them to become Christian. And he comments that many of the young people are very attracted to what he has to offer, because they'll respond to him when they hear about the gospel. They'll say things like, "Well, you're not going to make me go back to my mom and dad." And he says, "I don't intend to. I just want you to get your life straight and to walk with Christ wherever you're going to go." He makes the Christian demands on them, but he's recognizing you don't have to live in a house to follow Jesus. Some very interesting kinds of things going on. But we need to do some more thinking about that on the streets, too. Let me mention one more thing that comes out of mobility for church growth. This is number 5. Making use of our previous discussions. Remember we talked the last time about a typology of the cities? Some cities will be more open to change than other cities. For example, and we mentioned, you remember last time, these regal ritual cities. Regal ritual cities, by their very definition, are often intimately linked to the preservation of old ways, to the preservation of traditional religion. They will not be as open to change as industrial cities. Cities with a more cosmopolitan style, with more commerce, are often more mobile. They may be more receptive than smaller cities or more provincial cities. Cities with populations that come from a more animistic background, they will be more open to the gospel, for example, than cities that are in rigidly Confucian settings. Example, Pyongyang. Pyongyang was the old capital of Korea. It was very quickly became known as the Jerusalem of Asia because of the tremendous number of churches in the city, schools, Christian schools, etc. It was massive growth. Why? Not 100 to 200 miles away were the provinces of Chungcheong provinces. Even today, if you go there, the church is the weakest there in all of Korea. Why? Pyongyang was an animistic setting. Chungcheong provinces were where the strongest Confucianism was. Where you have strong Confucian roots, you have, I think, more resistance to the gospel. Where you have cities where there's more animism, people are more open. uh, Confucianism hangs on to the old traditional ways. The animist is always living in fear.
Is this the same also among the Chinese community? Those who are really follow Confucianism, they are not that easy
to.
But generally, Chinese people in South Asia are enemies. Usually, Confucianism could to make people feel more superior in a sense.
Right. I think it's had the same effect in Korea too. You have the old Yangban culture, you know, the noble culture, and Confucian traditions, and they always felt a little bit superior to everybody else. Another difference, I think, same connection, about some cities being more open than others. World-class cities with strong international connections. Well, these cities are more subject to outside influences, to outside thinking. Even more than large cities without these international ties. These large cities are sometimes called world-class cities. Now, a world-class city technically has two characteristics. Number one, demographics, a population of at least 1 million people. But a world-class city also has an international flavor. It has international connections. It may be finances, Tokyo. It may be culture, Paris. It may be economy, San Jose. But it is a world-class city, not just simply because it has lots of people, but because it has these international ties. Now, when you have a city with international ties, you have a city that is constantly making connections with outsiders, constantly being bombarded by new ideas, meeting new cultures, back and forth. So cities that are genuinely world-class cities are more open than cities with just 1 million people that are not international. So, for example, the church grows faster in Kinshasa than in Addis Ababa. Why? Because Addis Ababa has very few connections with the world community. Kinshasa is one of the centers. So the church grows faster in Rio de Janeiro than in Recife. Why? Because Recife, though it's a very large city, is isolated from the political, social, economic life of Brazil. So Rio de Janeiro has more churches, Recife has less. Churches will grow faster in Los Angeles than Philadelphia. So for example, there are, and this has nothing, not simply because there are more people, but because the style is different. So for example, there are 400 churches, Korean churches in Los Angeles. There are only 100 in Philadelphia. Now, the size of the Korean community is different, but it's not just that. It's also, Los Angeles is a more international city than Philadelphia. And that also plays a factor. This is also especially true in what are called primate cities. I don't know if that language is familiar to you, but a primate city would be a city where the which is growing significantly larger than the next nearest city. I was talking to somebody recently, one of our students, who was from Taegu, and I asked him how big a city was Taegu now, and he said it's about 1 million people, and I couldn't believe it. Taegu was a much smaller city when I was there, much smaller. Now it's about as big as Busan was when we were in Korea. Also, it's a city of massive numbers of churches. I suspect even more churches than per capita than Seoul, Korea. But it is not a primate city. Because the capital, the population of Seoul is, what is it now, Mr. Han?
More than 10 million.
More than 10 million. So, and the nearest, the next largest city would be Busan, wouldn't it?
And
that 4 million. So there's a big gap between the largest city and the second largest city. And that's what's called a primate city. When you have a city where the gap between the first largest and the second largest is so huge. Now I'm suggesting that primate cities, therefore, will see more rapid social church growth than secondary cities. Because they're larger, because they're more mobile, because they have more connections, because there's more movement. So it's tied in with mobility. I think all of this is saying we don't need to fear mobility. Sometimes mobility may be the greatest friend you possibly have. there's ways to make use of it in terms of church growth. That's a positive asset that the city offers us. Let me start on the third function of the city. The third function or image of the city is power. We talked first about that the city centralizes things. Now we're saying that what is centralized is power. Folk culture in a rural area is much more regional. And so power is shared along somewhat autonomous but interconnected lines. And let me draw you a picture to illustrate that.
If we're trying to draw a picture of a folk or a rural culture and the way the power functions, it would sort of be like this. In a folk culture, the power just moves back and forth between the lines, all interconnected. But by contrast, in urban culture, urban culture tends to centralize power and centralize it in itself. So the city gains control. And you have things like this. Here's your regional lines, just like here. Only what you notice is that now there's they don't just exist all alone. Now there's all these interconnections, and the interconnections go to and come out of the city. It's a very different picture of power.
So urban culture then sort of tends to gather this power into itself. The city gains control. It takes on authority, for example, in matters like knowledge, education, even religion. Communication within an urban system is to the center and then out again, to the city and then out. Now, in this new model, the older connections are not lost. That's why you still see all of those, the regional hookups, the older links between the rural systems. They continue to flow from village to village, usually through regional networks, joint activities. You have a market. You may, if you're in the mountains of, in the Andes Mountains, there'll be a traveling market that will come through. It comes through regularly, a certain time, every week, every other week. You know when it comes. You go to the market, that's where you exchange information. You don't just buy and sell, that's where you talk. What's going on in your village? Well, what's happened in yours? What do you think of this new politician? Why haven't they brought electricity yet? And the market becomes the center of communication. Maybe festival day. It may be one of the big festival days in Bolivia, or in the Andes Mountains, is the festival day where they for the adoration of the Virgin. And it's more than just a religious ceremony. That's when everybody puts the work aside and sits down and talks. You go back with your family, your friends, you find out what's going on. The communication lines continue from village to village through all of these different means. But in the city, something new happens. In the city, a system is created linking the village to the city and back again. Now, a lot of discussions are going on about just exactly what are these, what is this power, what are these power structures? You just got massive differences. I think the easiest way to define power is to just basically call it the ability to achieve ends. The ability to achieve ends or goals, even over opposition. Or the potential to alter another's behavior. Now, we'll have to do this next week. I think this is very, what we need to talk about as we talk about power, is to see the connection between power, urban power, and religion, because it is very closely tied together. And then to talk about the implications of this for church growth. But we'll save that for next week.